Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. By this time, you've gotten all your Christmas wrappings tidied away, I hope.
You're probably still eating leftover turkey, I shouldn't wonder.
Probably. And moving on into the new year, that's coming up too.
Turkey soup, I think, where we are. I think that's probably what's on the agenda for today.
Could be. But at any rate, we wish you a very happy 2015. It's kind of an odd number. It makes me wonder about that. But we're thinking big because today's show is focused on a big state, Texas.
Yeah, used to be another country, and I still think they are. And the cuisine is very distinctive. In different parts of Austin, which is right in the middle, seems to be a real hotbed of excellent dining and a new style cuisine that echoes the old, and it features quite a lot of pig, probably more pig than beef, which is really kind of surprising. And that leads us to the last interview on the program. Isn't about Texas, but it is all about the pig. So that's what we're all about today.
I just think we ought to say that we do get a whole bunch of books about Texas cuisine. And the University of Texas Press is a really remarkable publishing establishment.
Yeah. Well, we did a program about Texas not more than a couple of months ago.
Exactly.
Because there's a lot going on down there, and we're going to go find out about it firsthand sometime in 2015, I'm sure. So
we love Jack Gilmore, and he's first up.
Oh, yes. Jack Allen. It's very confusing because he uses his middle name in the name of
Jack Allen Gilmore.
Yeah, he uses his middle name in his restaurant. And His son has a restaurant too, and Jack says he's a lot better chef than he is. It's altogether a very, very intriguing story as well as a great cookbook. So here goes with, what's it called, Love? Jack Allen's
Kitchen. There seems to be a whole lot of new interest in the culinary scene in Texas. I don't know if it's because Austin has been put on the map recently, but we're talking again to another cookbook author, Jack Allen Gilmore's book called Jack Allen's Kitchen, Celebrating the Taste of Texas. And your restaurant, Jack, is Jack Allen's Kitchen, right?
Right.
I was really impressed reading about your travels, your education, your experiences. You've learned, it's like street smarts. You learn doing, and you've done little niches of everything, even including working in a Chinese restaurant.
Right.
So, just briefly, how did this all come about, the fact that you are now cooking?
Well, how it all came about is back in the late 70s, when I started working in a restaurant. I was a busboy at first, and you know, it was cool to be working in the front of the house with servers and guests and all that stuff, but I was very intrigued with what was going on in the back of the house with the kitchen and the dynamics of cooking steaks and seafood and things like that. So I was pretty intrigued with it, and then one day a cook walked out, and the owner says, get back in the kitchen and help them out. And I didn't know what I was doing, but there was kind of that certain amount of jazz and energy that I really liked at 15 years old. And it kind of evolved into, back then and to this day, even to this day, I don't care what restaurant you work in this country, you're still a short order cook. Somebody's calling tickets and you're firing something and you're starting something and it's all going to come out together. It's still, at the end of the day, you're a short order cook.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way I approached the whole thing forever.
You're right. Some of the kids coming out of culinary school think that they're learning to be a TV chef.
No. I think the really good thing is being a chef has been glamorized so much in the last 10 or 15 years that it's a cool thing to do.
Yeah, well, you've experienced that. You've been on TV and won contests on TV, haven't you?
It's more than just the glamour part of it. But if you're after that, you can probably get to that. But it's more than that. But what TV did was glamorize being a chef.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of made the chefs the next rock stars.
Oh, yeah, they're rock stars. Yep.
To this day, and I didn't even start calling myself a chef until 5 or 6 years ago. Because I never went through the proper training. But I did go through training by working with some incredible chefs.
Oh, you've learned so much. I mean, such a diversity in your experience.
Yep. So I learned from German chefs, Chinese chefs, Cajun chefs, Southwestern chefs.
Mexican,
vegan chefs, so on and so forth. And you kind of take that little approach of learning from everybody you can, and then move on, and then learn from somebody else. And that's what I tell my guys to this day is, like, learn as much as you can from everybody around you. To this day, I mean, 20 minutes ago, I learned something on how to make a bark for one of our desserts.
Uh-huh.
But I always learn something every day from people that I'm around. And then what you need to do to be a really good, successful chef is be humble and listen to everybody, take it in, and not think you know it all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, but going forward, I think chefs have been glamorized, and I think it's cool. It's great for business, but I think the next rock stars in our industry are the farmers themselves,
and
the cheesemakers.
Yeah, your book is divided rather conventionally, actually, among the into the four seasons. But you're doing something now that a lot of other cookbook chefs are doing, is you're saving space for the producers, the farmers, who you get the spirits from, the distributors of seafood, and you have sections in all of that. Some of them are written by them, right?
Exactly, or they were interviewed by us, and the bad thing about doing a cookbook is you're committed to a certain amount of farmers, because I left a lot of the farmers out. I didn't do it intentionally,
yeah.
So there may be a second book, but the farmers themselves I wanted to really honor, and we have such a loyal response to our farmers and people that use them, and people, the farmers got it tough, man. They got to deal with Mother Nature.
I know.
And if Mother Nature is supporting them, then they'll have a pretty decent season. So the next step after them having a decent season, because Mother Nature was favorable with enough rain or not too much rain or wasn't cold enough or just perfect amount of cold, things like that, and then when they harvest, if Mother Nature was semi-kind to them, then all of a sudden they have a great harvest and they have to have a venue to sell it. And I stepped up to the plate 5 years ago when we opened up Jack Allen's Kitchen and said, count on me. Anything you produce, I will buy. And I won't haggle with you. I won't argue with you. But if you say you're going to deliver me something, then I want you to deliver it to me. So, and those are strong words when you come up to a farmer and say that, because all of a sudden they plant their crops to provide for Jack Allen's Kitchen. And by the way, when I say Jack Allen's Kitchen, I'm talking about two really busy restaurants, about to be a third.
I was going to ask you that, yeah.
And then my son's restaurants are Odd Duck and Barley Swine. He's probably one of the best chefs in the country.
Yeah, your son went to culinary school.
Yeah, and I'll tell you a story about that in a second. But, yeah, my son went to culinary school in San Francisco, and he came back with a very, very huge passion about local farmers, seasonal vegetables, seasonal chops, and seasonal this and seasonal that. So he's the one that turned me on to this farm movement, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. But the farmers know they can count on us. They're going that extra mile to take care of us. And they hate it when they have to pick up the phone. By the way, most farmers nowadays have cell phones.
Yeah, I know.
They don't always answer it.
Yeah.
And they don't always text. But they'll call you. They'll reluctantly call you and say, you know what, we got too much rain or we got too much cold. We're not going to be able to supply you this week. And then because we're very versatile in Austin and there's a lot of growing regions in Austin and the Hill Country area, we'll find it from somewhere. So fortunately, somebody had too much rain or not enough rain, but the guys 50 miles away are fine. So,
yeah, we interviewed that woman who wrote the Texas Food Bible, and she delineates in the book all these different growing regions. I mean, you're really blessed in Texas.
Yep.
But Jack, how long has this local, if you like, this local food movement been going on? I mean, when you think of Texas, if you're naive, you think of Texas and lots of cows running around.
Yep.
And you don't really think of the crops that are grown surrounding urban areas in the rest of the country. But obviously that happened. Was there a particular trigger that caused that to happen?
Well, Texas, I mean, the whole Southwest, actually, but in Texas in particular, there's two four seasons. There's actually four seasons, fall, winter, spring, and summer. And there's a little bit of overlap in between. But, you know, where I grew up in South Texas, without even knowing it, the food I ate came right from the farm. I'm not saying the meat did or the chicken did, but it probably did. But everything else came right from the farm, all the way from citrus to chili peppers to lettuce to greens to whatever throughout the season. And I just took it for granted growing up. But here in Austin, we're within 100 miles of being in South Texas. We're you know, south of San Antonio, where it barely climbs to 40 degrees, and, you know, you get to about 90 degrees, 95 degrees. There's a lot of versatility where you can believe the spinach I got today that was grown this week outside of San Antonio in Poteet, Texas.
The one you're talking about in your book where you accidentally experimented with frying it?
Yeah, I threw a bunch of spinach in the fryer just to see what would happen, and it splattered all over my face. I was getting burned. But she showed up with these incredible spinach that she put in the ground in late September, and we've been fortunate enough to have good weather. But we'll have spinach between now and February because of the growing region here.
Who are these people, Jack? Are they?
The ones I'm talking about are my friends over at, her name is Cora, out of Poteet, Texas, and her farm is called Oak Hill Farm.
What did she do before?
I don't know, ma'am.
You don't know.
But she is an incredible, incredible farmer. She does, throughout the season, she'll do spinach this time of the year. She's the queen of strawberries. There's a strawberry festival in Poteet, and she's the one that supplies all the strawberries. And she's just unbelievable, cherry tomatoes and things like that. But she's just an example of the 40 or 50 or 60 farmers that we deal with. But to answer your question about farm to table, there was people 15 years ago, 20 years ago that's done it. My friends over at Wink Restaurant, Paul and Eric, and they've been doing it for a while. And I was a corporate chef for 20 years, and I couldn't do it.
Exactly.
I couldn't do it because of what it cost.
Yes, yeah.
You know, people think fresh, local product is cheaper, but it's not.
No, it's a whole lot more
but
expensive.
But it's better. Yes, it's better, and you got to put a value to that.
Now, you have the usual suspects in this book. You have a steak, you have tacos, you have chilies. You also have extensive sections on jams and jellies and your own salsas, of course, drinks, very creative drinks, and pickles, a ton of pickles. Now, is that very Texas?
Yeah, it is. You know what it is? So from a restaurateur or even a homemaker at your house or a farmer, if you're going to buy 4 pounds of cucumbers, what are you going to do with it? So you make a salad out of it one, then you'll pickle the rest and do this and do that. But it's kind of like that thing. If you're going to buy it, then use it and try to use it. The cool thing in the last 8 to 10 years is the nose to tail on a pig or a cow or a goat or a sheep. So use every part of it. If you only have a season for 3 months that's got the perfect cucumber, what are you going to do with it the rest of the year? So you pickle it or you cure it or you fry it or you do something with it, and you just kind of try to preserve it. And preserve is a big word for us, because when we get into seasonal, like citrus is seasonally here in Texas, South Texas, I can get the perfect oranges, perfect lemons, limes, and grapefruits.
Oh, those ruby grapefruits I used to get.
Yeah, for about 6 months. It's what are you going to do with it when you get a bunch and take care of it? So we make jams and jellies and things like that. And it's the same thing as the Hatch green chilies from New Mexico. You only get it for like 3 or 4 weeks a year, and that's why you buy 10 or 15 or 20 pounds, and you roast them and you freeze them. So,
yeah, we got lots of those.
Yeah.
We got lots of those this season.
So curing and take care of them is kind of what we really, really want to do. I can't get fresh okra right now in Texas, but I've got pickled okra in my walk-in.
Yeah, I like pickled okra.
Or my storage unit.
I like approach to, you want the little ones so they're not so gelatinous. I think that's great. And you roast them, because we like them on the grill to get rid of that.
Best way to do it.
Yeah.
Best way to do it. But I'm probably sitting on, 400 400 pounds of pickled okra right now that I'll have till next March till we start growing it again.
So what do? You stuff your Thanksgiving turkey with pickled okra?
Hey, don't knock my Thanksgiving turkey, man.
I thought that was an unlikely combination.
but you'd be surprised. But you know, we get into it, and we, you know, right now, you know, I walked. We have a little house out here outside of Austin, and just this week, I went and picked about 300 or 400 bulbs of prickly pear from a cactus.
You picked it?
Yeah,
I did that once. I only did it once.
I pick it with tongs. I don't even touch them.
Yeah, well, I talked to this Arrigo people who specialize in prickly pear. They have all different colors of them, really.
Yep.
And they're trying to develop a seedless variety, which I think is pretty pointless. But they have, their pickers wear head-to-toe leather.
Oh, I can imagine.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
because you're walking through a cactus field. I'll walk around it like a little girl, and I'll just pick them with tongs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't know about that.
You sound like a smart guy.
I couldn't get these pricklies out of my clothes, no matter how many times I put them through the washer.
Here's the real story. She was stealing prickly pears.
So she was going into somebody else's property, grabbing them, grabbing their own prickly pears, right?
I said, these are the wages of sin.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I loved was you have a lot of a relationship with Gulf Waters and Steve Finn from there.
Yep.
And I loved your. You said that the first time you ever had shrimp, the head was on, and when you became a chef, you thought seeing a headless shrimp was the strangest thing.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
It is true, because, you know, I grew up, I actually, when I was about 15 years old, I went shrimp, and I saw right from the waters, and I saw what it was supposed to be like. I remember as a little child getting shrimp from some friend's house and eating the heads. They fry the whole thing. And I always tell people, you know, the best, God bless the sushi restaurants nowadays that are doing head-on shrimp, and they don't even really care about the middle of the shrimp. They care about the tail, and they care about the head.
Yeah.
More than they care about the true meat. You know what I mean? So it really is one of those things. And you take that stuff for granted, you know, but it's shrimp head to tail. You're going to eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then what's more popular on a restaurant menu nowadays than pig face or pig tail or pig, you know, trotters and things like that. So you got to respect the animal. You got to respect the product that you have and try to use as much as you can out of it, because somebody took a lot of care and patience and love into growing whatever they're growing.
Now, you have here, you have the annual Farmers Appreciation Lunch.
Yeah.
But I wanted this, before we wrap this up, I wanted you to have an opportunity to explain the work you do for the Lone Star State Paralysis.
Lone Star Paralysis?
Yeah.
Yeah, so aside from, Jack Allen's is a very community-driven restaurant. We take care of a lot of different charities. Number one is we're family-driven. Our staff is like our family. I know everybody that works for me's names. I'm ashamed to say I don't know their kids' names. All of them, but I know a lot of them. And then going past that, same with the farmers. I know the farmers. I know the kids' names. I know what they're doing. We anticipate where they're going to be growing for us and things like that. So it's kind of, we built this restaurant concept on taking care of the community. But my biggest biggest focus is the Lone Star Paralysis Foundation.
Yeah, raising
money. And it's a foundation that was started by Doug English about 35 or 36 years ago, and his goal is to provide an opportunity for people that they're in a wheelchair that may have an opportunity to walk one day. So here in Austin, there's a big rehab, I don't want to say clinic, but a rehab facility where folks have a chance to come in and work with some really good nurses and really good physical therapists and things like that to give them hope. And if they work hard enough and if they're lucky enough, they'll walk out of a wheelchair and start walking again.
You said you've seen that. That must be.
And I've seen it happen every, I've been involved for probably the last 10 years, and I've seen it happen multiple times.
That's amazing.
I saw a young man the other night. I won't tell you his name, and I saw him a year ago, and he was in pretty bad shape about a year ago. He's doing phenomenal right now, a year later. Nice. And it could be something as jumping in a swimming pool that's not enough water and you break your neck.
Yeah, I know. I've done work with these people.
You know what I mean? And we provide hope, and we see it work. But tirelessly, we do a lot of events with them to raise money for the right reason. And we actually have a menu item on the menu called a Carl Miller's Queso, where we provide, every time a queso is ordered, we put money into the Lone Star Paralysis Bank and support them. And the reason why it's called Carl Miller's Queso is I do an event every year where they auction me off, and I go cook anywhere anybody wants for 12 to 15 people, and Carl Miller's bought it for the last 9 years.
You said that in the book.
Yeah, and he's paid up to $15,500 for it.
Sounds like a great man.
He's an incredible individual.
I can't resist asking one more question. Why is it that your son has his own restaurants and doesn't work with you? Most people, fathers and sons, work together.
Well, that's actually a really good question, and a lot of people have kind of asked me that differently, but your question is dead on. Bryce, I'm old school where I run busy restaurants. I operate busy restaurants, I'm just a little different. He's very serious about food in the most positive way.
Yeah.
And he's the next generation of just a badass chef.
Okay.
I mean, he is by far one of the best chefs I've ever seen. And I didn't want him to carry on the family business. I wanted him to do his own thing. And without even me saying that, that's what he wanted to do. So I gave him the opportunity to learn how skillet worked and learn how to use tongs and how to fry fish and how to cut fish and things like that. And he took it one step further and took it to the next level. And you know, we always thought my wife and I have been married for 33 years. We always thought he was going to be an architect. He was going to be an architect. He was one of those nerdy kids that would build models of houses and pools and condos and things like that. But at the end of the day, a chef is an architect. There's a little artist in every chef.
Yeah.
So he just took it the next. I didn't want him to carry on the family business because, in reality, he's his own guy. But he's an incredible chef. What I'm real proud of about Bryce is he's taken on what I wanted to do, and that's be community-driven and take care of certain charities and take care of his people. And to this day, he doesn't care about all the accolades that he's getting.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't care about being the number one restaurant in town or the top 10 chefs in food and wine or Jane Beard Foundation, you know, nominees, Southwest Chef. He cares about his people. And if you take that approach, then good things are going to happen.
Okay, so you heard it here, listeners. And it's Bryson Gilmore, who you're going to hear a lot more about, right?
Yeah, Bryson is actually, his middle name is Allen, too.
Oh.
So it's Bryce Allen Gilmore, so.
Well, don't look, but pretty at some point you're going to find us in your restaurant. So.
I can't wait. When you guys get to Austin, you need to call us because you're going to have fun.
Okay.
This is, and here's, I don't know if we're still on the air or not, but this is, I would say Austin is the culinary quest for a lot of chefs from New York to San Francisco to California. Because Austin's just too cool. It's music. It's got seasons. It's not too cold, not too bad. Actually, it's pretty damn hot. and the traffic is terrible, but it's a beautiful town. And when you were talking about thinking about cows and cowboy boots and all that stuff, it's so opposite of that. This is such a cool area of Texas. But Texas is full of cowboy boots and cows and all that stuff.
And prickly cactus.
A lot of cactus.
Listen, Jack, we got to go. It's snowing here.
Oh, it is. Sure.
All right, buddy.
Okay, Jack, thanks for
talking. God bless
y'all.
Y'all have a good one.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
We should have told you that Jack had a fairly large amount to say. Perhaps you'll need a break, and so we'll take one, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And now a really major research operation resulted in this next book, which is called Texas on the Table by Terry Thompson Anderson. And it will not take you very long to figure out that Terry is a she.
Yeah, not only that, she's something of an expert.
Oh, yes.
And she lives in an intriguing little town called Fredericksburg, Texas. I bet you didn't even know there was a Fredericksburg in Texas. I certainly didn't until we got to talk to Terry. And she's real knowledgeable and shares that knowledge in this encyclopedic book all about the Republic of Texas's fine cuisine.
Terry Thompson Anderson, this book, Texas on the Table, was indeed a revelation for me, and also I believe for Peter. When you think of Texas, or you used to think of Texas, you thought of what? You thought of big steaks and chili and barbecue, and that was it. And this book, you point out a startling difference of the size of the place, of course, and all the different districts, the different terroirs. It's amazing. Everything's blossoming. Is that the whole point of this book?
Yes, definitely, definitely. We wanted to dispel the notion that Texas is all about barbecue and arid, dry regions, and there are the many, many people in Texas that are producing sustainable, fresh, wonderful, good-tasting food.
Yeah, now, I mean, we know that Austin has been a hot center development of the level of high level of food and artisanal food. But then when you start, yes. You have a lot of things. It reminds me, we interviewed people years ago about the cheese activity in Texas. And there's ever more of all of this stuff, right?
Right. We just were amazed by the quality and number of cheesemakers in Texas. Of course, we feature Paula Lambert at the Mozzarella Cheese
Yeah, she's the one we interviewed a long time ago.
She was the pioneer,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and we now have just wonderful cheesemakers in all regions of the state, even in far, far west Texas.
Now, let's do something interesting here, because you have acres and you have terroirs and regions and all that kind of stuff. But I seem to remember somebody introducing me to the size of Texas by saying, if I started driving in Dallas, it would be the day after tomorrow before I got to El Paso.
That's correct.
So that gives you an idea. It's kind of a lot of geography out there.
Right. And a lot of it is up and down and windy and twisty.
Well, you have here in your introduction, Texas is a big state. It covers more than 276,000 square miles in 10 distinct climatic regions, 14 diverse soil regions, and 11 wildly divergent ecological regions. Can you walk us, our listeners, through some of that difference in terroir?
Certainly. We, of course, if you start on the Texas coast, we have a great many marshlands. Texas is actually the end of the central flyway for migrating birds.
Wow.
So down in the coastal area, you have just thousands of acres of beautiful marshlands, in addition to, of course, the sandy coastline, which is 800 miles in length.
Everything in Texas is big.
Everything is big. And then as you travel up the east portion of the state, it's heavily timbered land. It's actually known as the Big Thicket. There was a lot of logging activity there in the early part of the 1900s. Then as you head west, of course, you get into the fertile region of the Brazos Valley, where a great, great many of the state's crops are grown. And the Rio Grande Valley, of course, supports a huge citrus industry. As you move up into central Texas, You get into ranching country and a lot of peach and apple orchards, the Hiram Lakes country. And then as you move west, you get into the really huge ranches and the oil industry. And then up in the Texas Panhandle is proving to be our greatest grape-growing region. Of course, Texas has a thriving wine industry, and they are just growing some fabulous varietals of grapes up there in the Panhandle.
Now, they're also doing that in the Hill Country, though, which is where you reside, correct?
The Texas Hill Country wine region is the largest in terms of numbers of wineries in the state. We now have over 300 wineries in Texas.
You know, a long time ago, we were at the mansion at Turtle Creek, and
yes.
And Peter posed a challenge to the sommelier and said, we only want to drink local wines. And at that time, it was a stretch. Now, it's not a stretch.
Well, I actually pulled the poor man's leg, and I said, whenever we're in a foreign country, we like to be sure that we taste wines of that country. And he was not upset. I said, your challenge is to find a red wine and a white wine from Texas to serve with our dinner. And it turned out that he had actually produced a book on the subject. It wasn't bound, but he had like 300 or 400 pages of wines from Texas from which to choose.
Goodness.
And we were very, very pleasantly surprised. And I'm talking now, that was 25 years ago, if not
yes.
longer. So clearly there's a lot more development gone on since then.
Oh, definitely.
So you decided, foolishly, I'm sure you later learned, that you were going to celebrate this bounty in a book. And it's not a small book.
Right, all 4.5 pounds of it.
Is it 4.5 pounds?
Yes, it is.
Oh, wow.
Well, now, let's go back now to saying, well, obviously you're excited about the state in which you live and you want more people to know about it, but what is it other than that that you were trying to do with this book?
Well, as I said, we're trying to, of course, make people aware of how we can eat in Texas today, that we have this bounty of fresh, not only livestock, but produce and locally made wines. And we wanted, as I said, to hopefully make people think about their choices for where they source their food.
Now, you feature, you're obviously smitten with the local producers, many of whom you met for the first time when you were researching this book.
Right. Many were old friends, and many we met during the process of this book.
Now, was your audience Texans or was it non-Texans? Or perhaps it was both?
For the book.
Actually, both. We have had fonts among all age groups to this book. And we have actually had some really young people, I mean some high school kids that have expressed an interest in learning about their state through this book.
And you know, actually, interest in cooking is getting younger and younger and younger. I don't know how many recent cookbooks for children that we've received.
Right.
Really, it's pervasive, isn't it? This is an adorable photo, by the way, of this little girl holding the chicken.
Oh, isn't that just wonderful?
It is beautiful. And I use that as an opportunity to point out that, in fact, your sister was a very talented photographer, Sandy Wilson, who went on this journey with you. How many miles did you log?
A little over 30,000.
Texas is big.
Yeah, and that just got you as far as El Paso.
you had plenty
of other places to go.
And they were actually more miles than that because my brother-in-law and sister have an airplane, and there were some of the regions where we went down in far, far southwest Texas, that were virtually inaccessible, and husbands didn't want the two of us driving in those regions where there's no road signs, no roads, and no cell phone reception.
Yeah, no, you have a number of hair recipes. We're going to have, on Peter's birthday, we're going to have rabbits, not hares, but just rabbits. And some of these look really good, the rabbit recipes. I think I was most thrilled of all, though, to see that you have a real turtle soup recipe in here for real turtles.
Right. And did you read the story of my turtle hunt?
Yes. We should say that you also have a lot of little anecdotes and things in here so that another of your goals is achieved, because it's interesting reading. It's more than just a cookbook. Do you think is going to happen next? You've covered all bases here. I love your crab stories, too.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that crabber is actually an old friend of mine, and he's just the salt of the earth kind of person. And a perfect example of the kind of person we wanted to feature in this book, to show how hard these people work to provide good, tasty things for us to eat.
Are the capers from there, too? I mean, you make everything. You grow everything, produce everything in Texas.
Yes. Yes, we do.
I mean, you know, you find those in Sicily and Italy, but I guess you get the similar, if you look at all the cactus growing in Texas and all the cactus growing in Sicily, you can see that there would be regions that are similar in climate. Now, you've written other books before.
Yes, this is my eighth book.
Oh, wow. What is this, the one with the big paella pan-looking thing?
Oh, that Leslie Horn produces. She's also featured in the first chapter of the book.
Right.
With her, at her processing plant. She produces a wonderful, all-natural Spanish-style chorizo, which, of course, is a dry-cured chorizo as opposed to the Mexican-style chorizo.
Oh, yeah.
And she's become known kind of as the paella queen around the state because she makes these wonderful paellas using her chorizo. And the quail produced by one of our quail farms here in the hill country.
Do they grow rice in Texas, too?
We certainly do. We grow lot of rice down in the coastal plains region around Brazoria County and Katy, Texas. As a matter of fact, we have a sake producer in Austin that is producing one of the only organic, all-natural sakes in America, and he sources his rice, which is organic and all-natural, from the state of Texas, literally kind of in his backyard. So we really do grow just about everything here.
Yeah, and, the other thing I think we should note is that you've really developed two specialty seafood industries. One is your Gulf Coast oysters, which are really becoming famous, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I am a great cheerleader and do everything I can to promote our Gulf oyster industry, because those folks work so hard, and, of course, they're totally at the mercy of hurricanes and red tides and all of the other horrible things that plague the industry. But the exciting thing is the new Appalachian program, which is enabling them to actually make some money.
Yeah, that I loved reading about that. You have so much juicy information. I was going to also mention your shrimping industry, which is I'm sure it's picked up a lot of slack in the industry from other Gulf areas that were polluted with various incidents and so forth. So so that's becoming a big industry. Well, you have me convinced, I must say. Again, this book is Texas on the Table by Terry Thompson Anderson, with photos by her sister Sandy Wilson. And the subtitle is People, Places, and Recipes, Celebrating the Flavors of the Lone Star State. And indeed, this beautiful book does that. Terry, I thank you for taking time to talk to us.
And right after the break, we're going to move to another state that starts with a T for exposure to that wonderful southern delicacy called the pig.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
It's always good talking to an old friend, and we first met Chris Chamberlain, not in his hometown of Nashville, but at the Greenville Food and Wine Festival. But I guess it's obvious subject. Southern Foodies is the series name, but this one's called Guide to the Pig, and I don't think there's anything more southern than the reverence and variety of ways of handling the pig in the South, in southern restaurant kitchens, or southern kitchens, period. But I've never read a book as thorough as this one, Chris, about this pig.
Well, I appreciate that compliment. It was a fascinating subject to work on, and after my first book, which was more of a travel guide, had 100 restaurants in it, we thought it would be fun, my publishers and my editors and I, to concentrate on a particular topic. So the pig came naturally to mind just because it's such a popular protein here in the South, and it's got a neat sociological history that goes along with it.
Well, you have the logo for this is a pig, and where, you know, the pig is usually broken down into its different parts, this is broken down into its different states. I love that.
I was really proud of that. That was one of my aha moments while I was working on the book.
I see. And the book, of course, is subtitled A Culinary Tour of the South's Best Restaurants and the Recipes That Made Them Famous. And also, How to Select, Prepare, Cook, and Enjoy Everything But the Oink, which is a southern saying, isn't it?
It is. No. Yeah, that was, I've always, in my daily job, I write restaurant profiles for magazines and for websites around the Southeast and a couple national gigs, too. But I wanted to make sure to include the travel component in it as well, because that's the basis of the Southern Foodie series, which is telling people where to go eat great food in the South, giving the stories behind the restaurants and the chefs, and also sharing the recipes directly from the kitchen. So I think that's kind of a nice niche for the series.
Yes.
And it's always wonderful that chefs are willing to share their recipes, which are really their most sacred secret.
Especially in the barbecue business, huh?
It is. It's fun. I've talked to a lot of people in barbecue, and they say if somebody won't share their secrets with you, they're probably not the best in the business.
Oh, really?
People that really have been doing this for years and generations make it a point to teach new people about it. They want to preserve the culture.
Oh, interesting.
And some of them have told me, oh, I'll give you all my procedures because I know that most people aren't willing to do the hard work to get it done. So, sure, they'll tell you how to cook a pig for 22 hours, but that doesn't mean that you're actually going to take a shovel and some concrete and go out in the background and dig a pit.
That's for sure.
That's true. And I guess it's fair enough to say that there's plenty of diners to go around, especially these days, right?
Oh, indeed. Yeah, I mean, back from the days when they first started to promote pork as the other white meat, I think people have realized that as far as usability of the animal from nose to tail, the fact that it's so versatile, the fact that it's got all these different regional methods of cooking it make it so popular. Plus, it's just darn delicious.
Peter wanted to ask a question, but I wanted to, before we launch into it, I wanted to point out the structure of the book so that people have an idea of what they're exactly getting on the subject if when they buy this book. If you start out with everything you ever need to know about pig, right?
Yeah, I call it, it's kind of separated into three sections. The first one is what I call the anatomical tour of the pig, which takes you through all the parts and also the history behind why certain parts of a pig are cooked in different ways and the benefits of being able to use a whole hog if you wanted to, or break it down into its component parts and cook the chops or the loin or the ribs separately. And then I went to real masters of the trade to get some techniques for how to do, example, you know, Pat Martin at Martin's Barbecue gives his whole hog procedure, and Kerry Bringle, Peg Leg Porker, shared the way he makes ribs at home. And then Chris Lilly, who's the Memphis and May champion barbecue pork butt cooker get his techniques for doing a home butt or a shoulder at home. So I thought that was great to be able to have them. And that allowed me to write some of the history and some of the sociology of why different regional rubs and recipes and techniques and sauces have come into play. And then from there, I wanted to move on to a more of a geographical tour of the pig and highlighting some of the great chefs and pitmasters and just home cooks that are doing a great job cooking pork and accompanying products all over the Southeast. I like to tell people they should probably buy two copies of this book so they can keep one in their glove compartment and one in the kitchen to get a little bit dirty with.
Great. And then, of course, it's not clear cut. I mean, the battle rages on about barbecue, doesn't it?
It definitely does, and it's always a fun source of discussion. It's one that I love to listen to, but I don't put too much credence into it when you realize that they all come back to a common ancestor of when the first immigrants came into the South. It was pretty tough living down here, and the pig was a great indigenous protein that one person could cook by themselves. So you don't see many people go out and try to cook a whole steer in their backyard, but just about anybody can cook a pig. No. And where all those regional differences arose from were really based in the backgrounds of the immigrants that came here. They all discovered fortuitously at the same time that the best way to take this sturdy little animal and break down the fibers to make it palatable was to cook it slow and low over a wood fire, and that introduced what I call kind of a southern terroir, where in Mississippi it may be over pecan wood, but in Tennessee it may be over hickory, and in Texas it may be over oak. So what is couched as being a regional difference is really just based on the fuel supplies around.
Now, Chris, at the time when these original Southerners were cooking pork, was it wild? I mean, I think we've heard somewhere that the pigs came over with the Spaniards, but they pretty soon got their heads together and thought it'd be more fun to escape and explore America on their own. So were they at that stage back in the 1700s and 1800s, were the pigs wild or were they domesticated?
Now that's absolutely true. I mean, pigs go feral at the drop of a hat, but that also made them a pretty available supply for anyone that could hunt. So they might be in the scrub marshes of South Carolina, or they might be running along, you know, through the mesquite plains of Texas, but they were these big, again, sturdy, hardy animals. And so even if you could get a whole pig, you had to find some way to break it down to where that tough meat would be palatable for just right. Everyone in the family to enjoy. So that also meant, since it's such a big, big animal, that lots of curing came into play. If you couldn't eat a whole pig at once, you had to find a way to make it last throughout the winter. And so that led to these wonderful inventions of country ham and bacon and pork belly and all sorts of, you know, cures and preserving methods.
But did they actually domesticate the wild pigs, or did they just shoot them?
No, they did. Certainly pig farming started up in the 1800s.
Oh, okay.
So the good thing is a pig can't jump a fence.
Okay, got it.
So if you can get them fenced in, you've got a good chance of raising your own little crop of pigs.
Now, have they been changing now? I know in many of the other parts of the world, including my native land, there's been a focus on specific breeds that happen to have characteristics that you might want if you're going to cook it this and such a way. So there are old spot pigs, and there are Gloucestershire pigs, and Anne saw a picture of one the other day that is like the belted Galloway steer, except it's
has a band around it.
A pig with a band of a different color around it. Is this happening in pig raising in the United States?
There's an organization.
Well, it definitely is. The vast majority of pork that most consumers are going to buy are big commercial breeds of pigs that have been bred to really come to the median of what people like out of a pig, and that's the proper size, and it's got the proper amount of tenderness. But we've bred a lot of flavor and a lot of fat out of the pigs. One of the differences between pig and beef is the way you look at the way you grade a steak is the amount of marbling that's in the actual meat. So a USDA Prime or a Wagyu is going to have all that beautiful fat marbled through the protein. But on a pig, most of the fat lives between the skin and the meat. So they've gone to a less fatty pig. That's the commercial farm pig. And there's a big movement out there to go back to these heritage breeds, to go back to the Mangalitsas or the Ossabaw Island pig that are very specific to a region and have their own characteristics. You know, a Mangalitsa is a huge, long-haired pig. It'd be pretty scary if you ran into one in the wild.
Yeah, you'd be pretty frightened if you saw
one. They're very fatty. That's a fatty pig.
Now, there's a section where you alphabetically describe, is it about 50 restaurants across the South that you really like?
That's correct.
And in the book, they're positioned alphabetically. Are they indexed geographically? I didn't get to see that.
They are. In the back of the book,
okay.
There's a listing by state of the restaurants.
Got it.
And then there's a separate index just for the recipes by restaurants.
Okay, great.
One difference between this book and the first Southern Foodie is that we recognize that there's a need. You can't just have a book that's just bacon, 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 pig, pig, pig. We really wanted to have a more complete cookbook that we can organize in a more traditional way of having appetizers and side dishes, main dishes,
and desserts
and drinks
Desserts were funny. I mean, okay. Who thinks it's...
But just in case people thinking it's all about pig, that's really not entirely true, because many of the favorite dishes of the South are in there as well, like shrimp and grits.
That's correct. That shrimp and grits does have a little bit of ham in it, because that's from Louis Austine.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's his famous recipe for... It's one of the prototypical shrimp and grits recipes, and I was really pleased that Lewis was nice enough to share that and contribute that to the book. But we wanted to make sure that people could use this cookbook to take advantage of the complimentary dishes, and that's what we asked the chefs at the restaurants and the pitmasters to contribute, was definitely give us a couple recipes that do feature the pig, but also some complimentary recipes that you would serve in the restaurant alongside with it. And then we fleshed out the third section of the book with all sorts of good down-home recipes that just work nicely at any sort of meal that might feature pork in at least one or two of the dishes, but also with the side dishes that aren't necessarily pig-centric.
I want maple, bacon, and cheddar biscuits.
Mm-hmm. Don't those sound great?
Yes.
And they're really easy to make.
Well, you've got some really wonderful characters in there, like Frank Lee from Slightly North Abroad.
Oh, is he in here, too?
I didn't see him. Oh, sure, he's in there.
I missed it.
Snob would have to be in there. High Cotton's in there.
Yeah, I know that they're in there.
Cypress isn't in there.
Cypress isn't in this book, but Craig Deal's a friend of mine, and he is a master at charcuterie.
Right.
A couple of the difficulties that you run into when you put together a book like this is, even when you talk to the greatest barbecue pit masters in the world, I mean, their restaurants really only have about four things on the menu, and that's why they're so focused. And you really don't need six different coleslaw recipes and nine macaroni and cheese and six potato salads in a book. So that's why we tried to augment them with other great side dishes that would fit with it. And then when you run into the masters like Craig Deal, some of his charcuterie is so specialized and so intense in preparation that it really wasn't appropriate for the home chef. So we tried
that'd be too hard.
We tried to make sure that the recipes that we chose were scaled for the home kitchen and also featured, for the most part, ingredients that you could find easily either in your favorite supermarket or online.
Here's a question. How did Alan Benton get to be so good? His bacon is legendary throughout the United States. I think it was John Besh in Restaurant August in New Orleans who first told us that he used Alan Benton's bacon, and now everybody seems to, and he seems like such a wonderful character.
He's a great character, and he's very self-effacing. He won't admit how important he is. He just considers himself a little country boy from eastern Tennessee where he's working now that just does a job. He says, "It's not rocket science. If it was, I couldn't do it."
Oh, he has a master's degree in education.
I told you, he's just so modest about his techniques. But there are a lot of places in that region of the Virginias and Tennessee and the Carolinas that do some amazing hams.
Alan's
ham has a very intense smoked flavor based around the smokehouse that he built himself. And he had planned really just to make a living doing what the people he grew up with was, which was making hams for basically the small community. You have to raise a pig to get those hams. There's a supply chain problem if you try to suddenly ramp up and become huge and national.
Well, you know, we used to buy bacon and whatnot from a place in Kentucky, and this place has prize-winning country hams that go for five figures at auction.
Broadbent?
Exactly. We always
I've got a friend named Steve Coombs, C-O-O-M-E-S, who's a writer out of Louisville,
and he just published a book specifically about country hams. So he goes even more in-depth on the subject than I did, but it's a fantastic read if that sort of stuff interests you.
Well, I mean, the idea that somebody's going to pay this kind of money for it is for charity. You know, it goes to charity, but I'm sure it's five figures easily.
If you think about what you'd pay for a Spanish Iberico ham.
Oh, yeah, well, I don't buy those either.
It's probably pretty close, though. When you look at it, though, that's when you think of the care and the time that it takes to do a three-year cure on a ham, that's the same situation as the difference between buying a 23-year-old Pappy Van Winkle whiskey or something that's just 3 years old. You're also paying for the artisan and his time.
Right.
And that's kind of where Alan gets along, you know, at Benton's. He earned this reputation making great hams just for the people of East Tennessee, but then famous national chefs like John Besh and David Chang and Sean Brock discovered his hams and his bacons and started including it on their menus, and that makes it spread virally at that point.
Tell me, before we go here, I opened this book, and there was a wooden sculptures of hams. And pigs.
And the little staff sculptures?
There they are. And it reminded me, it's not quite the same, but we had a friend gave us one that was a little bit more scatological. It was called Making Bacon.
I remember that was a dice set, wasn't it, where you rolled them?
No. This was actually a wooden sculpture.
And that was their statue for you?
Yeah, and they gave it to me as a present, and I can't remember where it ended up, but it was on the mantle for a long time. But this is not about that, right?
Not at all, no. That was from the mind of my wonderful food stylist, Teresa Blackburn, and the photographer, Mark Boughton.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really proud that there's no fake food in either of the Southern Foodie books. We made and then shot and then ate everything that you see in the books.
You don't look any fatter.
Real food.
You don't look any fatter, Chris.
Well, you can find me at the YMCA just about every morning. So
I know that route. I know that route very well.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be back in Nashville because we had a great time, but we ran out of time, and we didn't run out of restaurants, so. We'll engage your assistance in trying to make sure that next time we come, we fill in all the blanks that we should.
And please let me take you to see Kerry Bringle at the Peg Leg Porker. You'll be entertained and you'll enjoy
like
a delicious
riot.
Meal.
Well, thank you so much again on behalf of all our listeners around the world. If you want to eat the American South, this is the book you have to have.
Well, I appreciate that. That's awfully kind, and it was a fun book to work on.
Yeah, it was good talking to you again, Chris.
So there you have it. If there should be any doubt in your mind left that two of the top culinary destinations in the United States in 2014 are Nashville, Tennessee and Austin, Texas, you heard about it here, and go check it out. And go check out our program again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.